The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for. The nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com. Welcome to Farming the Countryside. I'm Andrew McCray. Thanksgiving may look different for most of us this year, but we all usually take a break to relax for a moment over the holiday. This week, we pause from the agricultural issues we normally feature to instead hear the interesting tale of a family who knows all about life on the rails. I think you'll enjoy this unique perspective on life, and it's our topic for this week's Farm in the Countryside, brought to you by Pivot BioProven. It's time to rethink nitrogen. Pivot BioProven replaces nitrogen fertilizer with microbes that adhere to the crop's root system and apply nitrogen each day. 2019 performance report data shows Pivot BioProven consistently outperforms synthetic nitrogen fertilizer year over year, providing corn growers improved yields and a more dependable nitrogen supply that isn't lost to the environment. To read the performance report, go to pivotbio.com. And for more information on Pivot BioProven, text PROVEN to 31313. So as I mentioned, I thought it might be nice to take a break of sorts this week. We've had plenty of news from agriculture that we've been featuring. That's what we try to do on this podcast. But every once in a while, it's fun to catch a story that may not be directly tied to farming. As you probably know, I broadcast a daily feature, American Countryside, about interesting people and places. I was recently in Britt, Iowa, which is home to the National Hobo Museum. When I inquired about doing an interview, they asked if I'd like to interview some hobos. Well, of course I did. So I drove to Britt, and we sat down at a little park to visit with New York Maggie and Connecticut Shorty. That's their hobo names, and as you'll hear, their family has quite a story. So here's my Thanksgiving feature about the hobo way of life. All right, well, first of all, I'm going to have each one of you just give your name. That way we know who we're visiting with.
New York Maggie, National Hobo Queen, 1994-95.
All right, yeah. And
Connecticut Shorty, National Hobo Queen, 1992-1993.
Let me start with this. You know, people have in their mind an image of a hobo. Is the image that we have at all right, or what is a hobo in your mind?
Well, a hobo is an itinerant worker. It is nothing the image that people have.
Yeah, they wander to work and work to wander. They had a wanderlust, and they might have had maybe 50, 100 jobs in their lifetime because they had to keep moving. The road was always calling them, but they always worked. Where we might have 1, 2, 3 jobs, maybe 5 if we're really a little flighty ourselves. But but they really kept going. Every couple of months, they felt a call and moved on.
The two of you are both, would you say, both hobos? What, give me your life story. How do we get this title?
Well, I'd say we're more hobo types than hobos. I have ridden about 5,000 miles on the rails on freight trains. But our father, Connecticut Slim, was a steam air hobo. He hoboed for 44 years. We were raised by our mother, of course. He wasn't home, you know, supporting us the way the conventional kind of family. So in 1990, he caught the westbound in Parkersburg, West Virginia. So in 1990, we came to our first hobo convention 30 years ago. We've been coming back ever since, by the way. And we came here to bury him. And because we were, daughters of a famous hobo, really, the hobo community, steam air hobos and other hobos in the community itself, which isn't necessarily all real hobos, took us under the wing, more or less, to speak. And we just started coming back and eventually became Queen of the Hobos, and I, you know, rode some rails, and I'm on the board of directors for the Hobo Museum since the early 1990s, and we just got involved, and here we are.
Tell me about your father's life then. How long was he gone, and what types of jobs, and was he riding the rails just to find work and just enjoyed that life? Is that right?
He was gone all of our childhood. He probably left maybe when I was 5, and I'm the oldest child. But we always heard from him. We always spent our summers at his sister's farm. And we know that he was a bartender and that he was a merchant marine and that he painted and that he harvested some crops.
So was he then, did you know where he was at? Did he like to work in one certain area, or do you know much?
From his sister. His sister would tell us pretty much. He wasn't personally contacting us. We heard through his sister, who we vacationed at her farm and went to her house almost every week with our mother on Sundays. We knew pretty much what was going on, but we didn't. I didn't have personal contact with him till I was probably 30 years old. He actually came. I was working in Terryville, Connecticut, because we're all from Connecticut. And he walked into a store where I was working. I was working in the office, and he showed up at this counter. And he, the woman said, "Somebody's here to see." I looked up. Of course, I knew it was my father. You know, he has a look. And so I walked up. I said, "Hi." He said, "I'll tell you the first thing he said to me." He said, "Hi, I'm your daddy. Do you need anything?" So actually, he had quite a sense of humor. And then somewhere else, then I didn't know what to do with him. So I took him up to, this was an upscale furniture store. So I took him into the front display window. So those big glass windows, the stores had. And we sat on a sofa and talked for a while. He had come to town because his brother had passed, and he had gotten his car left to him or something. That's what had brought him to Terryville, the town he was born and raised in. And then at some point during the little talk we had, he said, "You're beautiful. You look just like a cocktail waitress." He had a really a good sense of humor. I noticed he had my sister's smile. You know, my sister has a certain smile that, you know, I don't really have. We're a little different looking. And she picked up his smile, and it was a nice little visit, and off he went, you know. And then I didn't see him again for till 10, 15 years later. For some reason, I had read an article in the Hartford Courant, the major newspaper in Connecticut, and it said that last real hobo calls it quits, and then it was about my father, of course, Connecticut Slim. Is coming off the rails and settling in Parkersburg, West Virginia. So I made contact with him, with his rooming house down there. And I called the rooming house, and he had moved out 2 years before, because this was a lot of years. You know, it wasn't every other day or something. We were doing stuff. So she said, "I'll see if I could track him down for you." So I called her back a few days later, because that was the years of long distance before cell phones and stuff. And she had located him. So I wrote him a letter to the address she gave me and stuff, and he wrote back, and the opening words to that letter I received was, "Hello, long time no see." And then eventually I went down to see him and brought I have two children. I brought my kids down, my son and daughter, to meet their grandfather. And so we were, I'd say, friends for 10 years, you know, because of his hobo, and, you know, he wasn't, you know, around the family and stuff much, not our immediate family. And then when he caught the westbound down in Parkersburg, West Virginia, funeral people called me. So he must have had my phone number in his pocket or somewheres. And then so my son and I went down and made arrangements to have him sent to Britt. And so he's buried here in the National Hobo Cemetery.
You mentioned that your father was a famous hobo. So what made him famous? Was it the fact that he was, in a sense, the last of the hobos, or what made him famous?
It wasn't really the last of the hobos. That was just the title that the Hartford Courant chose, you know, to call attention to their article. But he was one of the more known hobos, especially in the Brit area, because he came here for many years, too, to the convention. He passed in 1990. But he also wandered enough and was known enough around the country so that he was known in all the hobo jungles and various places. I found a lot of addresses in his room after he caught the westbound, and I wrote to all the different people, and they wrote and said, "Your father would pass through every year, and he worked in our kitchen," and stuff like that. So he was well known. A small population of hobos got to be more well known, like that steam train Maury Graham I mentioned over there. He was known all over America. He became friends with a lot of country singers, Johnny Cash, June Carter Cash, Jim Reeves, the old-time country singers. So they got to be known just because of their character. You know, my father was kind of had a good sense of humor and was outgoing, would dance a little once in a while. Steam Train looked like Santa Claus, really, and he had the charisma like of a great showman, like a Barnum and Bailey showman, so people would really be attracted to him. So a handful of them got to be well known across the country as they worked and wandered.
So you mentioned that you have ridden the rails. I'm guessing both of you have over time.
Always stay home in case she needed bail.
So tell me about your lives then, riding the rail and watching out for your sister.
Well, we actually traveled together in a small motorhome for 12 years. We sold our homes. My sister had a home in Rochester, New York. I had one in Connecticut. And we hit the road together in this small motorhome, sold everything, and kept a couple of boxes of pictures. In the end, all that was important was your family pictures and stuff. And we traveled all around America for a dozen years, huh?
Yes.
And so we've been to all 50 states, 18 foreign countries, and we visited all 50 state capitals, went in them, you know, and toured them and stuff. So we've had quite a run. But I left, I think, 1996 and 1999. I had two adventures where my sister stayed with the little motorhome. And I, you know, rode the rails with some other hobos and stuff like that, you know, rail riders. I always rode with somebody that had been riding 25, 30 years. You know, always a man. Most people out there riding in the steam air hobo days were men, although there was some women riders. But I always rode with men when I, you know, rode the rails that I felt safe with. I never had any problems. And my longest trip was about 2,000 miles from Staples, Minnesota to Whitefish, Montana and back on the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, over the Rocky Mountains through Glacier National Park. You know, you can't beat seeing America from a rail, you know. So
when you do this, I mean, and I know times have changed. I've done some of these interviews over time, but at that time then, was it hard at all to ride the rails and be able to do this?
Well, you always have the chance of getting arrested. It's really a misdemeanor, but I've been chased out of rail yards. But being a smaller, older woman, they're not apt to take me to jail. They never did, but they could. You can go to jail for like up to 10 days and get a big fine. And today, since 9/11, they're really more worried about terrorism and violence and stuff. So today, if you ride the rails and get caught, you are more apt to really be arrested now. They can't. It's like more dangerous now, and people are more afraid. But in 1999, 1996, you know, the late 90s, when I was riding, I've been yelled at and threatened for jail and stuff, but people jump up and down and get red faces, but they never arrested me. So.
When you did that, were you doing it much like your father, that you would go for a while and then work, or was it more just to see the country?
It was more adventure and see the country. It was, when I rode with this hobo named Frog, we decided we'd do it the old hobo way. He rode 25, 30 years. He had a lot of hard times. But we went with no money, so we had to get across the country, the trip that was about 2,000 miles, get across the country and back with no money. But at one point we hitchhiked maybe 200 miles when our train was going the wrong way, which happens. And the man who we got out of the car gave us like $5. And most of the time when we got picked up hitchhiking, it was in pickup trucks. They'd let us in the back of their trucks. But other than that, Salvation Army, we went to a Salvation Army for a shower, and they gave us food. They gave us Spam, and even though we were, you know, we could be hungry because we had some food in our packs when we left. Actually, the second can of Spam we left in a little hobo jungle because we weren't really lovers of Spam, but it was nice that they gave it to us. And they give you a loaf of bread, you know, the Salvation Army. I didn't know these places. Frog knew those places, you know, so... But it was a grand adventure. I'm glad I did it.
Were you worried about your sister this whole time? Did she check in with you?
Well, she couldn't check in. It was the day before cell phones, or before we had cell phones. So I would always, like, watch the news and expect a call, but never got a call. I never really knew where she was, but I knew she'd be careful.
You said, did you make two big trips then? It was two different years? Is that when you did it?
Well, I rode in 1996 with Minneapolis Jewel, one of our hobo queens. We were the only two hobo queens to ever ride a freight train together. We went from La Crosse, Wisconsin to Minneapolis, Minnesota, was our freight train ride. and an adventure, you know, before and during, but that was the basic ride. And then in 1990, I went out for about six or seven weeks. And then I guess it was in the early 90s, I rode down the Mississippi River out of there was a hobo music and poetry festival, and a bunch of us got on a freight train and rode down to
Marquette.
Marquette, Iowa, down to Davenport, or way down the line somewhere. So that was the extent of it, those three different times, I'd say. That was my first ride was in 1993 with my Hobo King, and we rode from Dunsmuir, California, to Old Sacramento. Roseville Yards are just before Old Sacramento. Roseville, California is where you get off a freight train down there. And we rode a grainer, the back of a grain car, you know, it's called Riding the Porch. That's what we rode on down there. And that was another grand adventure. Then we had to hitchhike into Old Sac, where we were due for a radio show because we were king and queen in Old Sacramento. And so we managed to get a ride, and with some woman that took a shine to my king, Roadhog, because he was a smoothie, he was a professional hobo. And that was another grand adventure. I'm lucky to have been able to do that with good people.
Well, both of you have mentioned being queen. Talk about this, about the king and queen of hobos. How does this work out?
Well, in Britt, Iowa, every year, second week in August, we have the National Hobo Convention, and we elect a new king and a new queen. You reign for 1 year. You have to get up and make a 2-minute speech before the audience, which is your peers, the hobos, the hobo family, and all the townspeople. If you go over 2 minutes, you get pulled off the stage, and then by audience applause, you win your kingship or your queenship. And it's a kind of a competition, and during the week you go around and you try to get people to vote for you. You campaign so that you will be elected the next king or queen.
And why Britt? How long has it been going on in Britt, and why here?
It started in 1900, actually 1888, 89. The business people in Britt, a little group of them, decided, they had read in the paper that the hobos had been having meetings and conventions in the Chicago area, and they were unhappy, you know, complaining they were always getting arrested and being chased and stuff. So the business people in Britt decided, well, why don't we invite the hobos to come to Britt and have their convention here, and this will help get Britt well known and basically, you know, so to speak, get us on the map. And it was started as a railroad town originally, Britt. And so they contacted Charles Noe, who was the grand head pipe of hobos, who was the head hobo over the jungle and stuff, the hobo jungle. And he came to town in 1899 and met with a group of townspeople that were trying to get the hobos to come. And he got them to agree to give them free German suds, which is a German beer. And once they had free beer, there wasn't much of a problem getting them to come to Britt. And they came in on freight trains all over the country. There's newspaper articles in all the major papers all over the country about the hobos were coming to Britt. And they came for that convention, and they've been coming back ever since, over 100 years. We still have a hobo convention here, a real hobo convention where we meet and talk about, used to be more where the dangerous places are in the rails and where the jobs are and stuff like that. But now it's more if there's an issue in the town here, what do we need to do to, you know, straighten it out, because we don't want bad relationships. The city has done so much for the hobo community. And anything else people want to bring up that in general might impact the hobos or the hobo community as a whole. But we still meet once a year here.
Are those meetings, do you still have as many hobos out there as the time and culture and things changed over the years?
A lot, actually. It changed a lot. Right now I call the riders that come into Britt more recreational riders or riders for adventure. They're no longer working and wandering. A lot of them are young riders just going for the adventure. Last year we had Minnesota Jim here, was the last steam air hobo, I believe.
He's
still alive. He's in St. Paul, Minnesota. That was still coming present to Britt. Of course, there may be other ones around the country we don't know about. But the real hobos today in America, not that there isn't some random person, you know, that I don't know about, are probably mostly the Hispanic people out in California. What they're still doing, they're hopping on freight trains in Southern California, mostly, and in other parts of California, and they're riding freight trains to go up to Oregon and Washington State, and they're still picking crops and working on the farms. Then they'll ride a freight train and come back. And they don't say we're hobos. They probably never heard of a hobo, but they are living the classic lifestyle of a hobo. They're working and wandering. And to my knowledge, nobody's still coming to Brit is working and wandering. I would say the few older people may have rode a train, but they're not still working and wandering, which is the classic definition of a hobo.
The museum, of course, right now with COVID, you can't see in it, but what is in the museum? What types of things?
Oh, artifacts, handcrafts that different hobos have made. They show a movie giving it the history of people riding the train, riding the rails, pictures, a lot of pictures, and some of the towns. The town has always been involved with the hobos when they were in Brit. The town band that would be in the parade and
paintings, art. Walking sticks. There's a quilt, which is not really a quilt. I'd call it a stitchery of some sort, but it's squares put together like a quilt of denim, different denim, and it's different railroad symbols and sayings sewed with heavy string that the Texas Madman did. I don't know. He was a real riding the rails kind of hobo, and I don't know how he even could sew with this heavy string on denim, but we are lucky enough to have one of his, maybe even two, I think, of his masterpieces in there. And our father's memorabilia is in there. Frisco Jack was a knot tire. His knots are in there.
Yeah.
And Steam Train, who I mentioned, he has a bench in this little pocket park across from the museum. There's a whole case of his memorabilia. Pictures of him with Dolly Parton, because he was quite a character.
There's some tramp art. Years ago, hobos used to the cigar boxes were wood, and they would carve ornate boxes out of them. There's pieces of tramp art in there, or whittling. The hobo whittler has some art. Some of his pieces are in there.
Hobo nickels. The hobos used to change the look of a nickel to look like an Indian or something and sell those. And so we're lucky enough to have some of those. There's a nice museum gift shop where you can get, of course, T-shirts, but there's books, there's CDs and other hobo memorabilia in there. So
this park has several different signs and things. Those, and did you experience riding the rails? Were there different things that you would look for so you knew when you were riding the rails that this is different places you need to be?
Not my generation. That was more the steam era generation. And it was a subtle sign. Like we have the replicas of a lot of them on these signs. But mostly they were a little mark on a rock or a fence post or something, you know, an arrow or something. It wasn't, and I'm thinking in today's world, there's pages and pages of hobo signs on the internet and stuff, but I'm thinking there probably was less signs and they were more discreet and not as fancy as some of the ones that have evolved over the years, but they did definitely have a code of the road. Yeah.
What is it you'd like people to know about hobos, the life, whether it's the past or the present, even the future here with Brit? It's been an important part of both of your lives.
Well, I would want people to know that they are definitely part of American history, and they helped build America. They built the railroads. They picked all the crops before it was all automated.
And I'd like them to also know that the hobos were workers. They helped build America, helped build the railroads, helped the farmers and hundreds of other jobs. And they aren't the homeless people you see today, because... And today, without the background of the steam air hobos and the history of the older times, a lot of people mix up a hobo with a homeless vagrant person. And hobos were homeless by choice. They were not homeless because of circumstances in their life.
Good. Other things that I should ask you that I don't know to ask you are pieces of either of your stories that I should work in?
Cover it.
Oh, no, we could probably elaborate for hours.
I'll tell you, this Hobo House restaurant across the street from the Hobo Museum is a wonderful place to eat. They serve breakfast and lunch, but they also have a nice collection of hobo memorabilia. A lot of the hobos over the years have actually signed their wall, and there's some art in there and other artifacts. So if someone comes to the Hobo Convention or the Hobo Museum. We have a hobo cemetery where 18 steamer hobos are buried, plus others. We have a what we call a hobo jungle, which is a city park that turns into a jungle during the festival. But they should make sure to stop at this restaurant and check it out. It's worth it.
And I would like to add that going to the hobo jungle, we do a service there every Friday morning, and people need to know that we're not the caricature hobos. These were real people. They had real lives. They were wonderful men and women who were hobos.
I know one thing that I forgot to ask you is, how did you get your names, and how do hobos get their names? Is it something that is given to you?
Well, hobos usually got their names from other people. They'd see some characteristics about them, like, not necessarily a good example, but if they had lost an eye, somebody might call them Wood Eye, or Peg Leg Pete if they had trouble walking,
or by the trains they rode. Roadhog, steam train.
I gave my sister her name, New York Maggie, because she raised her family in Rochester, New York. Steam train, Myrie Graham. My original hobo name used to be Twinkle Toes because I'm a dancer. So in 1990, I was actually Twinkle Toes. I was in Logansport, Indiana at a railroad festival, and I actually won as Logansport's first hobo princess, because they don't have an election there like we do in Brit. And my name on the plaque they gave me was Twinkle Toes. Well, Steam Train pulled me aside and said, I don't like that name, Twinkle Toes, for you. It's really not fitting. He says, I want to give you a new name. He said, I think you should, your father's name was Connecticut Slim. I think you should be called Connecticut Shorty. And nobody was going to not take a name Steam Train give me. So right there in Logansport, Indiana, my name was changed. So...
Neat. And you said then the cemetery out here is kind of a hobo cemetery in a way. There's a place there.
The city of Britt gave the hobos a section of the Evergreen Cemetery, and we have buried all our dead known to us. Not every man. Some of them want to go to their own places, and they have graves out there. Some of them are, what do they call them? Anyhow, man-made by the other hobos.
Folk stones.
Gravestones.
Yeah. Grave markers. Yeah. Most of the stones out there were made by other hobos, so they're called like folk gravestones. And we know 18 of them. My father's buried out there, Connecticut Slim. Steam Train Myrie has a stone out there. That Myrie Graham, I mentioned him a few times. But there was also a lot of rail riders buried out there that weren't steam era generation hobos, but like My King Roadhog, Miss Steam, it was a little later generation, but he definitely hoboed. He worked and wandered. So there was hobos after the steam era generation, but pretty much by the 1960s or 70s, they were really, really fading out, the worker and wandering hobo. But there's a lot of them out there. There's, I think, probably almost 50 people are out there now in our cemetery.
When you were making your adventures, you mentioned that you never felt that it was that dangerous, but how do you deal with the elements and just getting on trains and getting off and just the cold and the hot and the rain and so forth?
Well, when I crossed the Rocky Mountains on the back of a double-stack container, it's open. We ride the back so we don't get the stuff blowing on us too much. And it was really cold, so I never sleep when I rode trains. I was too excited. So I put my sleeping bag, which was good for 30 below zero. So I'd put that over my head and wrap up to ride because you could be cold. I know when we slept in Whitefish, Montana, we were real tired. We just kind of laid down in a rail yard. It seemed a nice night at the time. We both woke up, Frog and me, soaking wet because it had rained on us. So we had to lay everything out to dry it out and everything. So you do have a lot of problems with elements. You take shelter the best you can. Under bridges, of course, it's a lot of hobos jungled up under bridges because it gave them an amount of protection if it did rain. Can't do too much about the heat, just hug shade. But it's a problem, can be a problem, sure.
What about catching the train, getting on and off, or do you just wait till you find one that's not moving?
Well, I'm a little person, in case, Shorty's my name. I'm just a little person. But so I didn't get on moving trains because it's too dangerous, especially, I don't have long arms and legs. But a lot of the riders, especially the steam air hobos, they could catch them what they call on the fly. They had a way of just swinging themselves up and getting on a train. And I always got off of them when they were stopped. So it can be dangerous. You have to always keep your wits about you. I know the first time I rode, I actually banged my head on something, and it was a wake up to me to say, can't just look down, you got to look up, you know? So, but it's, we don't recommend young people ride trains or try to ride trains because it is illegal, it is dangerous. It's something, you know, we did because, you know, we're maybe a little different breed, some of us rail riders. But it's best not to do it. It's best to just read the history.
The Hobo Museum at Britt is currently closed due to COVID, but will hopefully reopen soon. You can go to the town cemetery to see the unique grave markers for the Hobo Cemetery. It's a fun little town with quite a tie to a story that dates back well over a century. Thanks for joining me on this Thanksgiving week version of our show. I hope you've had a good Thanksgiving holiday. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you next time on Farming the Countryside. The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for, the nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com.